Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, education and the courts. And Richard, we base this conversation on a case out of Michigan that recently went before the Sixth Circuit. This is Gary B. v. Whitmer. And this was a case concerning the quality, which is to say subpar quality, of public schools in Detroit, which had a very interesting ruling, which we'll get to it in a moment. But before we even get there, can you just lay the groundwork here? Give us a sense of what was at issue in this case, what was being pressed.
The basic problem in this particular case is that there has been a complete and total abject and inexcusable breakdown in the provision of public services to the poor minority students who are in many key parts of Wayne County, which houses Detroit. And when you start listening to the description that the plaintiffs give of the way in which these things are organized, no textbooks for each individual student, completely chaotic organization, not rudimentary supplies, the whole thing speaks of a system which is in complete chaos. And as far as I can see, there was nothing in the defense that the state offers, because remember, the suit was not brought against the state technically. It was brought against the governor, in which they tried to defend this case on the grounds that, gee, we're doing a great job. It's just that you people don't understand. So the question then is, how do you get in that particular way and what should be done about it? And the suit essentially had a number of serious obstacles that it had to face, and the plaintiff's lawyers were quite ingenious in the way in which they tried to face them. The first thing they could not do is they could not make this a case of race discrimination, because 97% plus of the students in these schools are either Hispanic or African American. And it's very hard to say that there's some kind of discrimination within the district to favor one group of students as against another. Then you can say, well, it has to do with differences in funding. But that cuts in the opposite direction. If anything, the inner city schools get about 50% more funding than some of the suburban schools, even and rural schools, even though they have completely abject results. So you can't make the argument in that particular fashion. Third is, remember, there's a very complicated coalition going on here. And what you cannot do is to say the problem that we have here is union rigidities, work rules, and things of the sort. That is treated as part of the background. It is not treated as something which can be put into issue. So what they had to do is to dance around the question of what's wrong in this case. And there is a series of decisions, the most important of which is San Antonio against Rodriguez, which says that there is, quote, no fundamental right to education, the deprivation of which gives rise to a constitutional violation. And the reason why they wanted to say that is everybody is extremely nervous about creating positive rights, huge demands on budgets that come from courts who don't have the power to tax, and who are going to force money to be allocated from one business to another business when they're not sure that they are right. The most famous case of this took place in Kansas City and the amount in Missouri, and the amount of efforts that were used to try to raise the inner city schools to the level of performance of the suburban schools was just inordinate, and they could not be done. There's so much about education that depends not on what takes place in the classroom. It's the other unspoken thing. It also depends upon the way the children are educated at home, how much stimulation they get, whether they have solid breakfast, whether they take their meds on a regular basis and so forth, that the breakdown in the system is always going to be a combination of what's wrong inside the system and what's wrong in the larger kind of social society and what's wrong with the particular family. So what they did is they said, we can't talk about a right to education. So they made it into a kind of a quasi-democratic theory case. You have a right to a limited education so as to avoid illiteracy, which will then give you a chance to participate both in public deliberations on the one hand and also to be able to be self-sufficient on the other. And two of the three judges said, I think we could live with that. The third, who is my student and research assistant, a recent Trump appointee, Eric Murphy, took the opposite position and said that the basic prohibition still applies. And so the question then is, how do you deal with this case both in terms of the legal allegations and, more importantly, no matter which way the course comes out, somebody has to do something in order to improve the situation in Detroit. It is simply an inexcusable outrage for this kind of a status quo to persist.
A lot of people on the right bridle at these kinds of rulings, by which I mean rulings in which courts start to kind of de facto superintend the provision of public services, at least by kind of setting a floor. So another example that comes to mind, I'm not saying this is a perfect analogy, but California's prisons famously spent years trying to comply with judicial rulings mandating that they lower their inmate population. So there's the legal questions here, but there's also the policy one, which is how much of a danger do you regard it as to have the courts entangled in this fashion with those kind of administrative and to some degree prudential questions?
Well, the legal and the prudential issue in this particular case actually merged very pronounced. Let me give you a comparison in the private law. Many times what you do is you get a breach of a contractual obligation. And the question is, what do you do? Do you award damages at one poll, or do you require somebody to perform the obligation? It's called the writ of specific performance on the other. And there's no dominant solution to that question. So in the simplest case, if it's a question of whether or not you're supposed to convey land from one party to another, where the buyer will become the outright owner of the property from the seller, who then becomes just one of the many strangers to the land, it's a one-and-done operation. So that what happens is you can order the conveyance, and then after that, the court doesn't have any responsibilities. But when it comes to labor contracts, people get very, very nervous about having specific performance, because if you start to order that, and now the employer has to take back an employee that they don't want, and future disputes start to arise, the continuing ongoing relationship makes it extremely difficult to engage in this. And the general rule has always been, we don't have equitable remedies, that is where we command people to do things which we oversee, where the cost of oversight become extremely expensive. And so under that particular ground, if you're trying to figure out whether or not a court could supervise a prison or supervise a classroom within traditional boundaries, the answer is, by and large, they cannot do this. They basically intervene rarely. The guys inside the institution have 1,000 ways to, quote unquote, comply with the order while deviating from it in the day-to-day operation. Every time they want to lumber up the situation in order to have judicial intervention to oversee that, it becomes balky and costly. And so the courts cannot run a prison system. The courts cannot run a school system. God knows what it is that courts can run. They can't run a post office. And so the judicial limitations become, in effect, a large part of trying to shape the constitutional issues. And then you say, well, let's give damages. What does it mean to give monetary damages to several hundred or several thousand pupils in the Detroit school system? Where are you going to raise that money? What are they going to do when they get that money? So that even the damage side of this thing, which you could always allow an employment contract, turns out to be just terribly, terribly difficult. Adjudication doesn't work for the most part very, very well when you have these large and complex institutions that fail rapidly. And then the question is, can you figure out a sneaky statute, a sneaky strategy that allows you to overcome all of these incredible, incredible limitations on what it is that courts can do?
Richard, people who are familiar with the vocabulary of these debates will know the categories of negative rights and positive rights, which you mentioned earlier. In short, I mean, negative rights are duties upon other parties to keep from impinging on your liberty. Positive rights are duties upon other parties to affirmatively provide you something. And people on the right are generally supportive of negative rights and much more skeptical of positive rights, which that is easy enough to understand for the layperson if we consider a positive right that seems non-baseline, right? So if everyone's entitled to a three-bedroom condo, the problems with that are pretty obvious. But when we're talking about these sort of basic quality of life measures, a right to food, a right to housing, a right to, as in this case, a basic standard of education, it's easy enough to see why these things tug at the heartstrings. And the question that you often get is often, well, what's so horrible about an affluent society making sure that people at the bottom have access to these basic resources? Why wouldn't we say that they have a right to them? What's your answer to that?
Well, it turns out it's an answer which you say, amen, you're right. If you look at state constitutions as opposed to federal constitutions, they're really organized on very different lines. And so one of the features that you find in the Michigan Constitution that you find everywhere else in the state is that the state has a duty to maintain and to provide an education for all of its citizens, and it's supposed to be free, i.e. not by way of tuition charge in one form or another. And so what makes this really tricky is you get a federal constitution which says, we're not very good at trying to intervene. And then what you do is you get a state constitution which says, on the local level, we really are going to do this. And, you know, traditionally what happens is that courts sometimes want to enforce really powerful mandates on how money is spent. The most famous case of that is a case called Serrano and Priest from about 1971 or so, in which it turned out that you had a court which ordered some form of equalization of expenditures across districts, regardless of their wealth, so that instead of local taxes being the base on which you funded these things, you had to throw in a substantial dollop of state money. And in some states, it's worked okay. In California, it's been an extremely difficult thing to do. But nobody at the local government level can point to a constitution at the state level which is strictly negative rights. So you really are caught in an extremely hard case. And the question then is can you find some way to have a system of positive rights in there which doesn't get you into this incredible mess of trying to have a court try to micromanage a school system which is failing, fluctuating, complicated to do when it's utterly unequipped to do so.
So you make clear in the column, as you have here, that there is a lot legitimately to be upset about with Detroit public schools, and indeed there's a lot to be upset about with American public education in general. So if the solution is not to be found in a ruling like the Sixth Circuit's with a judicially defined floor on the level of acceptable quality, what would a better remedy look like?
Well, you see, what happens is if you take the two words provide and maintain, what you do is you're saying the state has got to do two things, and you could separate them. One of them is you could say, for those people who cannot afford it, it's going to be duty-bound out of general revenues, property taxes or income tax revenues, to actually pay for the education, but there's nothing which says that it has to provide for it. So if you go back to the early 1960s, Milton Friedman, in his very well-known popular manifesto book, Capitalism and Freedom, suggested something which he's argued for in many cases, which is the state does the funding, but it doesn't do the providing. And he called for a system of vouchers in which the parents would get the money, solve the wealth thing, and then go shop. There are a lot of objections to vouchers and a lot of arguments that could be made for them. But it's also the case that you have other forms of education that you can do. There's homeschooling, which is much more sophisticated than most people commonly think, because what happens is the old model of homeschooling is mom does all the education for the kid or dad does it. The modern view is homeschooling is internet-based. There are constant alliances. And so you get 6 or 7 or 8 parents, and they take turns teaching specialized subjects. They have ways to do sports and other kinds of collective activities. And so essentially, it's a kind of an informal system of education that is organized on a voluntary basis. And then there are charter schools, and these are schools which are essentially funded by the state. They're subject to various kinds of state mandates of one sort or another, but typically they're not unionized. And then it turns out that they're the standard public schools. So the suggestion that I made in this little column is I'm not going to be so rash as to say the only thing you could use is vouchers, because there are all sorts of other devices that might work. But rather than trying to superinvent and micromanage the situation, figure out what your existing allocation of dollars are. And then what the court has to do is to figure out how much of each of these types of total dollars are going to go to these various modalities. And so the theory is you don't increase the taxes, which is a non-starter, but you take the existing revenues, and then you set up a charter school system, you set up a homeschool support, and so forth. Suppose you just organize 25% for each of these four modes, and then let people come in and start to bid. And so what happens is the public schools will be under competition from the other schools. And if they don't get any supporters, you want to reallocate. And each individual school in any given category is going to be in competition with others. So the point here is to try to break the public school monopoly. Because as far as I can see, it's a mug's game to say, look, the state is in charge of the city. The governor's in charge of the state. She can be sued under Section 1983 for a deprivation of public right. She takes charge of it. what's she going to do? Exactly the same thing that's been done thus far. And what you have to do is fundamentally separate the allocation decision on money from the management decision. And what happens is public schools will fund better if all of a sudden these teachers understand that they're going to lose their jobs if they can't attract any students to start to come to it. And we know, for example, that there's a thing known as co-location, which is sometimes you have a public school on floors 3 through 6 and a charter school on floors 1 through 2. And the public school does better by virtue of the fact that it's co-located in the same building as a charter school. So what you have to do is to get the forces of competition in there. And what they did in this particular case is they wrote a legal opinion. The word monopoly just doesn't appear there. Alternative structures doesn't appear there. And so I think there are all the judges on both sides are wrong, but not thinking out of the box. And the trick is to get a series of remedies that reduce the incredible burdens of supervision and taxation. And the system that I've done would require some help. How do you get it? We send this case back to a trial judge, tell the trial judge you have to appoint a magistrate or a special master, and then essentially what you do is you commandeer the state funds, put it through this particular operation, and if the state wants to increase or decrease its budgets, you just simply keep the proportions going, and you make it very clear that those systems which get the greater amount of allegiance from various parents and their children will get more money. And I think that that has got much better chances of working than anything else. I regard this law school as simply saying we're replacing incompetent local administrators with incompetent statewide administrators. I cannot see how it's going to work. It just brings tears to your eyes to watch the way in which this lawsuit is conceived of as a theory of which state agency is going to be responsible. What you really need is a much more radical remedy. And oddly enough, the radical remedy that I propose is in fact one which puts less demands on direct overall supervision of the system for the reasons that I mentioned before, which is generally unworkable.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at definingideas@hoover.org. You can also follow him on Twitter. That's @RichardAEpstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.